some cases would doubtless be their dead bodies. She went on to write, "Why not a gathering of women writers?" the editors were asked. Well, why not? Which is not quite the same as why. In The Robber Bride, we meet three friends from college, Tony, Karis, and Roz, and their common nemesis and classmate, the beautiful, evil Xenia. Men in this novel are on the sidelines only. In this game, they are the ante, the chips, but not the players themselves, not really even the cards. Men are marginal, symbolic. As texts, they are hack, minor, obvious, predictable. It is the women Atwood is interested in. She wants a challenge. She wants to have fun. As with the fairy tales requested by Roz's daughters, she wants women in all the parts. "Who do you want the robber bride to murder?" asks Tony, the story of the title's revised grim tale. "Men victims or women victims, or maybe an assortment." The girls remain true to their principles. They do not flinch. They opt for women in every single role. Tony is Antoinette Fremont, a war historian and a professor at a Toronto university. She teaches and researches the history of war while Operation Desert Storm mobilizes abroad. In her cellar, using peppercorns, lentils, and Monopoly pieces for the various armies, she sets up dioramas of ancient French battles. She is happiest in the company of people who had died a long time ago. Her friend Karis tells her such an interest in war is negative and carcinogenic. One of her university colleagues tells her that in not focusing on social history, Tony is letting women down. The history department, Tony thinks, is like a Renaissance court. Whisperings, gangings up, petty treacheries, snits and umbrage. Tony's stronghold is her house, where she lives and studies, childless except for her husband, West. For Tony, war is there. It's not going away soon. The personal is not political, thinks Tony. The personal is military. War is what happens when language fails. Besides, wars have their upside. While they're occurring, the suicide rate always drops. Tony's point of view begins and ends the novel. By giving such strategic positioning to this character, Atwood announces and reinforces her metaphors and themes. That victimhood comes in all forms. That evil is a fact, though not outwittable. That fighting fire with fire may have, for observers, its aesthetic and intellectual appeal. Atwood braids two other characters' points of view into the narrative. One belongs to the half-zonked but psychic Karis, a New Age Earth Mother, who, in the 1960s, drifted through her university years as if through an airport. Karis believes in breathing exercises and teas and juices. She believes you can refuse to participate in certain emotions.
"I like hamburgers, but I don't eat them," she says.
"Hamburgers are not an emotion," says Roz.
"Yes, they are," says Karis.
The other point of view is Roz's. She is the founding editor of Wise Woman World, a successful women's magazine that has not entirely lost its social conscience. Roz sees to it that the magazine gives generously, if wearily, to charities. Hearts, lungs, and livers, eyes, ears, and kidneys. Roz, Atwood tells us, has her own list. She still does battered women. She still does rape victims. She still does homeless moms. How much compassion is enough? She's never known, and you have to draw the line somewhere. But she still does abandoned grannies. She no longer goes to the formal dinner dances, though. Raucous and irreverent, during her marriage, Roz was also indulgent, vigilant, and wise. She checked her philandering husband for rust spots the way she would a car. She hoped that if he started to go bald, he wouldn't get his armpit transplanted to the top of his head. She sees the problems of her life mostly as narrative ones. Together, she and her therapist try to figure out what story she's in. If they succeed, they can retrace her steps,
they can change the ending. Though perhaps the fairy tales are right, she thinks. No matter what you do, somebody always gets boiled. Besides their alma mater, these three chums have one thing in common. They've lost men, spirit, money, and time to their old college acquaintance, Xenia. At various times and in various emotional disguises, Xenia has insinuated her way into their lives and practically demolished them. Charming and gorgeous, Xenia is a misogynist's grotesque, relentlessly seductive, brutal, pathologically dishonest. Her past is unclear and fictitious. She alternately passes herself off as the orphaned daughter of white Russians, or Romanian gypsies, or Berlin Jews. Sometimes she is broke. Sometimes she is dying of cancer. Sometimes she is a journalist doing research, and sometimes she is a freelance spy, part of some international espionage caper. To Tony, who almost lost her husband and jeopardized her academic career, Xenia is a lurking enemy commando. To Roz, who did lose her husband and almost her magazine, Xenia is a cold and treacherous bitch. To Karis, who lost a boyfriend, quarts of vegetable juice, and some pet chickens, Xenia is a kind of zombie, maybe soulless. There must be people like that around, because there are more humans alive on the Earth right now than have ever lived all together since humans began. And if souls are recycled, then there must be some people alive today who didn't get one. Sort of like musical chairs. Yet oddly, for all her inscrutable evil, Xenia is what drives this book. She is impossibly fantastically bad. She is pure theater, pure plot. She is Richard III with breast implants. She is Iago in a miniskirt. She manipulates and exploits all the vanities and childhood scars of her friends. Wounds left by neglectful mothers, an abusive uncle, absent dads. She grabs at intimacies and worms her way into their comfortable lives, then starts swinging a pickaxe. She mobilizes all the wily and beguiling art of seduction and ingratiation, which she has been able to use on men, and she directs it at women as well. She is an autoimmune disorder. She is viral, self-mutating, opportunistic. The narrative discusses her in conjunction with AIDS, salmonella, and warts. She is a man-eater run amok. Roz thinks, women don't want all the men eaten up by man-eaters. They want a few left over, so they can eat some themselves. Yet almost everything that happens, happens because of Xenia. And so the reader gets interested and waits to see what Xenia will do. When she seems to have died, the Rasputin-like Xenia comes back to life. What next? That we never actually figure her out or understand the mysterious cartoonish extremity of her pathology, or even for a moment get her point of view, is disappointing. For like Iago and Richard, she is no idiot. And surrounded by boobs and chumps, or even routine civility, she can feast like a shark. But she never gets her own aria or soliloquy, not really. She remains unsolved, unknown. Perhaps Atwood intended Xenia by the end to be a symbol of all that is inexplicably evil. War, disease, global catastrophe. Xenia is meant to have no voice of her own. She is only a mad reworking of everyone else's. But an otherwise terrific story suffers for this particular suspense, one that only resolves itself in a kind of narrative hash. In its pacing and staging, Atwood's conclusion is goofy, jerky, madcap, though certainly entertaining. The endings of her novels always seem to have perplexed and defeated Atwood, and in The Robber Bride, she self-consciously throws up her hands. Every ending is arbitrary, she writes, a little lamely, because the end is where you write the end. Still, The Robber Bride is as smart as anything Atwood has written, and she is always smart. In the Grimm story, The Robber Bridegroom, the clever heroine saves herself by telling a dream, a story, a fiction that contains the truth. In The Robber Bride, Atwood has avoided the entomological listing of recollected detail that made up so much of her last novel, Cat's Eye. Yet she retains her gift for observing, in poetry, the minutiae specific to the physical and emotional lives of her characters. A black leather suit makes Tony look like an avant-garde Italian umbrella stand. The neon of Toronto gives off a glow like an amusement park or something safely on fire. What's more, the novel opens with what may be the most eloquent and quintessential image of a woman in the late 20th century, despite the great variety. A working woman, Tony, in early morning, wearing only slippers and a dressing gown, frantically chases after a garbage truck, plastic bag in hand, because her husband, feckless though subsequently contrite, is supposed to do the garbage, but he forgets. 1993. On Writing. Recently I received a letter from an acquaintance in which he said, "By the way, I've been following and enjoying your work. It's getting better, deeper, and sicker." Because the letter was handwritten, I convinced myself for a portion of the day that perhaps the last word was richer. But then I picked up the letter and looked at the word again. There was the S, there was the K. There was no denying it. Even though denial had been my tendency of late, I had recently convinced myself that a note I'd received from an ex-beau, in what was a response to my announcement that I'd gotten married, had read, "Best wishes for Oz." I considered this an expression of bitterness on my ex-beau's part, a snide lapse, a doomed man's view of marriage, and it gave me great satisfaction. "Best wishes for Oz. Eat your heart out," I thought. "You had your chance. Cry me a river." Later, a friend, looking at the note, pointed out, "Look, this isn't an O. This is a 9. See the tail? And this isn't a Z. This is a 2. This says 92. Best wishes for 92. It hadn't been cryptic bitterness at all, only an indifferent little New Year's greeting. How unsatisfying. So now, when I looked at the deeper and richer, I knew I had to be careful not to misread wishfully. The phrase wasn't, finally, deeper and richer. It was deeper and sicker. My work was deeper and sicker. What did that mean, sicker? And why or how might this adjective be applied in a friendly manner? I wasn't sure, but it brought me to thinking of the things that I had supposed fiction was supposed to be, what art was supposed to be, what writers and artists were supposed to do, and whether it could possibly include some aesthetics of sickness. I think it's a common thing for working writers to go a little blank when asking themselves too many fundamental questions about what it is they're doing. Some of this has to do with the lost perspective that goes with being so immersed, and some of it has to do with just plain not having a clue. Of course, this is the curse of the grant application, for instance, which includes that hilarious part called the project description. Describe in detail the book you are going to write, wherein you are asked to know the unknowable, and if you don't, then just to say it anyway for cash. That a grant-giving agency would trust the specific and detailed description from a fiction writer seems sweetly naive. Though fiction writers are also allowed to file their own taxes, write their own parents, sign their own checks, raise their own children, so it is a tolerant and generous, or at least innocent, world here and there. What writers do is workmanlike, tenacious, skilled labor. That we know, but it is also mysterious. And the mystery involved in the act of creating a narrative is attached to the mysteries of life itself, and the creation of life itself, that we are, that there is something rather than nothing. Though I wonder whether it sounds preposterous in this day and age to say such a thing. No one has ever looked back upon a book she or he has written, only to find the thing foreign and alienating, unrecallable, would ever deny its mysteriousness. One can't help but think that in some way this surprise reflects the appalled senility of God herself or himself, though maybe it's the weirdly paired egotism and humility of artists that leads them over and over again to this creational cliché, that we are God's dream, God's characters, that literary fiction is God's compulsion handed down to us, an echo, a diminishment, but something we are made to do in imitation, perhaps even in honor of that original creation, and made to do in understanding of what flimsy vapors we all are, though also how heartbreaking and amusing. In more scientific terms, the compulsion to read and write, and it seems to me it should be, even must be, a compulsion, is a bit of mental wiring the species has selected over time in order, as the lifespan increases, to keep us interested in ourselves. For it's crucial to keep ourselves as a species interested in ourselves. When that goes, we tip into the void, we harden to rock, we blow away and disappear. Art has been given to us to keep us interested and engaged, rather than distracted by materialism or sated with boredom, so that we can attach to this life, a life which might otherwise be an unbearable one. And so, perhaps it is this compulsion to keep ourselves interested that can make the work seem, well, a little sick. I'm determined, you see, if not to read sicker as richer, then at least to read sicker as okay. Certainly so much of art originates and locates itself within the margins, that is, the contours of the human self, as a form of locating and defining that self. And certainly art and the life of the artist requires a goodly amount of shamelessness. The route to truth and beauty is a toll road, tricky and unpretty in and of itself. But are the impulses toward that journey pathological ones? I took inventory of my own life. As a child, I had done things that now seem like clues indicating I was headed for a life that was not quite normal, one that was perhaps artistic. I detached things, the charms from bracelets, the bows from dresses. This was a time, the early 60s, an outpost really of the 50s, when little girls' dresses had lots of decorations, badly stitched appliqué, or little plastic berries, lace flowers, satin bows. I liked to remove them, and would often then reattach them on a sleeve or a mitten. I liked to recontextualize even then, one of the symptoms. Other times I would just collect these little detached things and play with them, keeping them in a wooden bowl in a dresser drawer in my room. If my dresses had been denuded, made homely, it didn't matter to me. I had a supply of lovely gewgaws in a bowl. I had begun a secret life, a secret harvest. I had begun perhaps a kind of literary life, one that would continue to wreak havoc on my wardrobe, but alas, those are the dues. I had become a magpie, collecting shiny objects. I was a starling in reverse, harboring a nest of eggs gathered from here and there. When I was a little older, say 11 or 12, I used to sit on my bed with a sketch pad, listening to the songs on the radio. Each song would last 3 to 4 minutes, and during that time, I would draw the song. I would draw the character I imagined was singing the song, and the setting that character was in. Usually there were a lot of waves and seagulls, docks and coastlines. I lived in the mountains, away from the ocean, but a babysitter I'd had when I was 9 had taught me how to draw lighthouses, so I liked to stick in a lighthouse whenever possible. After one song was over, I'd turn the page and draw the next one, filling notebooks this way. I was obsessed with songs. Songs and letters. I had a pen pal in Canada. And I often think that this is what I tried to find later in literature. The feeling of a song. The friendly, confiding voice of a letter, but the cadence and feeling of a song. When a piece of prose hit rhythms older, more familiar, and enduring than itself, it seemed then, briefly, to belong to nature, or at least to the world of music, and that's when it seemed to me artistic and good. I exhibited other signs of a sick life, a strange elaborate crush on Bill Bixby, a belief in a fairy godmother, also a bit of journalism my brother and I embarked on called Madman Magazine, which consisted of our writing on notebook paper a lot of articles we'd make up about crazy people, especially crazy people in haunted houses, then tying the pages together with ribbon and selling them to family members for a nickel. But it was a life of the imagination. When I was older, I suppose there were other signs of sickness. I preferred hearing about parties to actually going to them. I liked to phone the next day and get the news from a friend. I wanted gossip, third-handedness, narrative. My reading was scattered, random, unsystematic. I wasn't one of those nice teenage girls who spent their summers reading all of Jane Austen. My favorite books were The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald and Such Good Friends by Lois Gould. Later, like so many of the afflicted, I discovered the Brontes. One enters these truly great, truly embarrassing books like a fever dream. In fact, fever dreams figure prominently in them. They are situated in sickness and unafraid of that. And that's what made them wonderful to me. They were at the center of something messy, but they didn't seem foreign in the least. In fact, very little written by a woman seemed foreign to me. Books by women came as great friends, a relief. They showed up on the front lawn and waved. Books by men, one had to walk a distance to get to, take a hike to arrive at, though as readers, we girls were all well trained for the hike, and we didn't learn to begrudge and resent it until later. A book by a woman, a book that began up close on the heart's porch, was a treat, an exhilaration, and finally, I think, that is why women who became writers did so, to create more books in the world by women, to give themselves something more to read. When I first started writing, I often felt sorry for men, especially white men, for it seemed the reasons for their becoming writers were not so readily apparent or compelling, but had to be searched for, even made excuses for. Though their quote-unquote tradition was much more celebrated and available, it was also more filled up. It was ablaze. What did a young male writer feel he was adding? As a woman, I never felt that. There seemed to be a few guiding lights. I, of course, liked the more demented ones, Sexton, Plath, McCullers, but that was enough. Admiration and enthusiasm and a sense of scarcity. Inspiration without the anxiety of influence. I feel a little less like that now, in part because I know the main struggle for every writer is with the dance and limitations of language, to honor the texture of it, but also to make it unafraid. One must throw all that one is into language, like a Christmas tree hurled into a pool. One must listen and proceed, sentence to sentence, hearing what comes next in one story, which can be a little maddening. It can be like trying to understand a whisper in a foreign accent. Did she say je t'adore or shut the door? To make the language sing while it works is a task to one side of gender. How often I've tried to shake from my own storytelling the phrase, and then suddenly, as if I could wake up a story with the false drama of those three words. It's usually how I know my writing's going badly. I begin every sentence that way. And then suddenly he went to the store. And then suddenly the store was brick. And then suddenly he had been asleep for 8 hours. The writer marries the language, said Auden, and out of this marriage, writing is born. But what if the language feels inadequate, timid, recalcitrant, afraid? I often think of the Albert Goldbarth poem, Alien Tongue, wherein the poet thinks wistfully, adulterously, of an imagined language parsed to such a thinness that there is a tense that means, I would have if I'd been my twin. What an exquisite precision tool such a tense would be for a writer. Whole rooms could be added to scenes, whole paragraphs to pages, books to books, sequels where at first there were no sequels. But then, excessive literary production, George Eliot reminds us, is a social offense. As far as language goes, we have to live contentedly and discontentedly with our own, making it do what it can and also a little of what it can't. And this contradiction brings one back, I suppose, to a makeshift aesthetics of sickness. Writing is both the excursion into and the excursion out of one's life. That is the queasy paradox of the artistic life. It is the thing that, like love, removes one both painfully and deliciously from the ordinary shape of existence. It joins another queasy paradox, that life is an amazing, hilarious, blessed gift, and that it is also intolerable. Even in the luckiest life, for example, one loves someone, and then that someone dies. This is not acceptable. This is a major design flaw, to say nothing of the world's truly calamitous lives. The imagination is meant outwardly to console us with all that is interesting, not so much to subtract, but to add to our lives. It reminds me of a progressive Italian elementary school I read of once, in which the classrooms had two dress-up areas with trunks of costumes, just in case while studying math or plants, a child wanted to be in disguise that day. But the imagination also forces us inward. It constructs inwardly from what has entered our inwardness. The best art, especially literary art, embraces the very idea of paradox. It sees opposites, antitheses coexisting. It sees the blues and violets in a painting of an orange. It sees the scarlets and the yellows in a bunch of Concord grapes. In narrative, tones share space, often queasily, the irony is quivering. Consider these lines from the Alice Munro story, A Real Life. Albert's heart had given out. He had only had time to pull to the side of the road and stop the truck. He died in a lovely spot, where black oaks grew in a bottomland, and a sweet, clear creek ran beside the road. Or these lines from a Garrison Keillor monologue. And so he tasted it, and a look of pleasure came over him, and then he died. Ah, life is good. Life is good. What constitutes tragedy and what constitutes comedy may be a fuzzy matter. The comedian Joan Rivers has said that there isn't any suffering that's one's own that isn't also potentially very funny. Delmore Schwartz claimed that the only way anyone could understand Hamlet was to assume right from the start that all the characters were roaring drunk. I often think of an acquaintance of mine who is also a writer and whom I ran into once in a bookstore. We exchanged hellos, and when I asked her what she was working on these days, she said, "Well, I was working on a long comic novel, but then in the middle of the summer my husband had a terrible accident with an electric saw and lost three of his fingers. It left us so sad and shaken that when I returned to writing, my comic novel kept getting droopier and sadder and depressing, so I scrapped it and I started writing a novel about a man who loses three fingers in an accident with a saw. And that," she said, "that's turning out to be really funny." A lesson in comedy. Which leads one also to that paradox, or at least that paradoxical term, autobiographical fiction. Fiction writers are constantly asked, "Is this autobiographical?" Book reviewers aren't asked this, and neither are concert violinists, though in my opinion, there is nothing more autobiographical than a book review or a violin solo. But because literature has always functioned as a means by which to figure out what is happening to us, as well as what we think about it, fiction writers do get asked, "What is the relationship of this story, novel, play, to the events of your own life, whatever they may be?" I do think that the proper relationship of a writer to his or her own life is similar to a cook with a cupboard. What that cook makes from what's in the cupboard is not the same thing as what's in the cupboard. And of course, everyone understands that. Even in the most autobiographical fiction, there is a kind of paraphrase going on, which is Catherine Ann Porter's word, and which is a good one for use in connection with her, but also for general use. I personally have never written autobiographically in the sense of using and transcribing events from my life. None, or at least very few, of the things that have happened to my characters have ever happened to me. But one's life is there, constantly collecting and providing, and it will creep into one's work regardless, in emotional ways. I often think of a writing student I had once who was blind. He never once wrote about a blind person, never wrote about blindness at all. But he wrote about characters who constantly bumped into things, who tripped, who got bruised. And that seemed to me a true and characteristic transformation of life into art. He wanted to imagine a person other than himself, but his journey toward that person was paradoxically and necessarily through his own life. Like a parent with children, he gave his characters a little of what he knew, but not everything. He nurtured rather than replicated or transcribed. Autobiography can be a useful tool. It coaxes out the invention. Actually, invention and autobiography coax out each other. The pen takes refuge from one in the other, looking for moral dignity and purpose in each, and then flying to the arms of the other. All the energy that goes into the work, the force of imagination and concentration, is a kind of autobiographical energy, no matter what one is actually writing about. One has to give to one's work like a lover. One must give of oneself and try not to pick fights. Perhaps it is something of a sickness, halfway between quarantine and operetta, to steal a phrase from Céline. To write intensely, closely, not with one's pen at arm's length, but perhaps with one's arm out of the way entirely, one's hand up under one's arm near the heart, thrashing out like a flipper, one's face hovering close above the page, listening with ear and cheek, lips forming the words. Martha Graham speaks of the Icelandic term doom eager to denote that ordeal of isolation, restlessness, cautness an artist experiences when he or she is sick with an idea. When a writer is doom-eager, the writing won't be sludge on the page. It will give readers, and the writer, of course, is the very first reader, an experience they've never had before, or perhaps a little and at last, the words for an experience they have. The writing will disclose a world. It will be that Heideggerian setting itself into work of the truth of what is. But it will not have lost the detail. Detail on its own contains the universe. As Flannery O'Connor said, it's always necessary to remember that the fiction writer is much less immediately concerned with grand ideas and bristling emotions than he is with putting list slippers on clerks. One must think of the craft. That impulse to make an object from the materials lying about, as much as of the spiritual longing, the philosophical sweep. It's impossible to experience one's own death objectively, Woody Allen once said, and still carry a tune. Obviously, one must keep a certain amount of literary faith and not be afraid to travel with one's work into margins and jungles and danger zones. And one should also live with someone who can cook, and who will both be with one and leave one alone. But there is no formula to the life or to the work, and all any writer finally knows are the little decisions he or she has been forced to make, given the particular choices. There's no golden recipe. Most things literary are stubborn as colds. They resist all formulas, a chemist's, a wet nurse's, a magician's. There is no formula outside the sick devotion to the work. Perhaps one would be wise when young, even to avoid thinking of oneself as a writer. for there's something a little stopped and satisfied, too healthy in that. Better to think of writing, of what one does as an activity rather than an identity. To write, I write, we write, to keep the calling a verb rather than a noun, to keep working at the thing at all hours in all places so that your life does not become a pose, a pornography of wishing. William Carlos Williams said, "Catch an eyeful, catch an earful, and don't drop what you've caught." He was a doctor, so presumably he knew about sicker and better, and how they are often quite close. 1994. Amos Oz. Amos Oz could not have chosen a more poetically suited name. Amos, the first literary Jewish prophet, Oz, the land of the wizard, and Hebrew for determination. In its mix of scold and humbug, its marriage of God and godlessness, Oz's name perfectly expresses the paradoxes of his native country. Born in Israel and the son of a Zionist, Oz has often been seen as one of the few strictly Israeli literary voices, rooted and homegrown, a Sabra, and as such he has often been read by his compatriots for whatever ideas of literary nationhood might emerge in his words. A prophet is not without honor even in his own country, if he plays his cards right, but a prophet will nonetheless overhear all those nagging questions around him. What is it that we have made? Who are we really? What is this guy going to say about us next? Oz's 11th novel, Don't Call It Night, is full of people drinking iced tea. It turns up every few pages. Set in the desert town of Tel Kadar, the book is a modest one, simply revealing the lives of Theo, a 60-year-old civil engineer, and his lover, Noah, a schoolteacher, both of them beset by the lassitude of their ordinary compromises and isolation. The desert, no longer hills, but like the notes of a muffled tune, has parched them. The bloom is off their romance. But Oz's book is interested in the ways these two people fight back a little, mostly via their domestic rituals, the coffees, teas, baths, and suppers, and it reveals a resigned but romantic belief that such rituals not only are full of beauty, but perhaps make up all there is of pleasure in life. Certainly, in Oz's careful lyrical prose, they possess a loveliness and truthfulness, and may be the book's primary substance. Anyone who has some goodwill can find goodwill everywhere, says an Irish traveler. It becomes one of the novel's refrains. The plot consists mostly of a collection of circumstances, small standoffs, and retreats. It is a story primarily of misorchestrated good intentions. A former student of Noah's has died of a drug overdose, and the boy's father, suspected of being an arms dealer, approaches Noah with the idea for a drug rehabilitation center dedicated to the memory of his son. The father will donate much of the money needed to establish it. Noah, flattered and amazed to be asked to head the center, runs some distance with the project. She organizes a small group of people to help her plan the clinic and its programs and to raise money. The idea of the clinic becomes an opportunity for the novelist to look at the stresses and petty dramas of the community. Oz has a particular affection for the local eccentrics, and he writes from several points of view. He even eliminates quotation marks, as if to say, "This is all one community. There is no important difference between one member and another, between inner life and outer, between voice and description, between people and land. It is all the same." Nonetheless, the reader will be most interested in the many parts of the story that focus on Noah. She is a terrific character. When we first meet her, her voice is young and bright, abandoning the ends of her sentences. She wafts a trail of honeysuckle scent through the apartment. She has recently been enlivened by the idea of the clinic. Though the project has whisked her away from the older Theo, who watches her comings and goings and bursts of enthusiasm with a certain patient skepticism. After all their years together, Theo feels himself still filled with ardor for her, though his condition is perhaps more accurately a low-grade longing. She has wandered off from him a little bit. They sleep in separate bedrooms. Her kiss has grown cousinly, and he spends his time waiting for her to return. When he attempts to help her out, as a city planner, he is better connected to the municipal powers that be, especially the mayor of Tel Kadar, and runs interference for Noah, establishing some critical public relations groundwork for the clinic. Noah wanders off from the project, too, seeming to lose focus, as if the whole thing had been spoiled for her by Theo's own interest and participation. The truth is that she is haunted by news she's received from a young woman named Tali, that the dead student was slightly in love with Noah. Also, she is told by Tali, drug use in the community is not widespread or a serious problem. This causes Noah to lose concentration. She suddenly begins spending inordinate time shopping and going to movies with the young woman. Is Tali a daughter substitute, or is Noah's preoccupation with her simply a denial of her own middle age? Perhaps it doesn't matter. "Noah's smoke without a fire," says someone of Noah's sudden attention deficit, and we are asked to see this as a vulnerability that she has always had, a dreaminess and restlessness she shares with Theo. Theo himself is a character one may recognize from Oz's other novels. He perhaps most closely resembles Fema from the 1993 novel of the same name. Both men share a certain kind of insomnia, drink much coffee and tea, do calisthenics, and love BBC news broadcasts. Both have complicated histories with women, which are filled with flight and impetuousness, yet which they see in a somewhat blinded way as essentially decent and generous. Both men are almost completely, if gently, self-absorbed. Their own gentleness hides them from themselves. They share as well with their author and with each other a love of the absurd and overstudied detail, such as this arithmetical bit from Fema. "They say at the beginning of this passion Fema weighed 159 pounds, and that in September, in the prison hospital, he weighed less than 132. Or this strange sly anecdote in Don't Call It Night. "Bozo's wife and baby son were killed in a tragic event here 4 years ago, when a young love-crossed soldier barricaded himself in the shoe shop, started shooting with a submachine gun and hit 9 people. Bozo himself was saved only because he happened to go to the Social Security that morning to appeal against his assessment. To commemorate his wife and child, he has donated an ark made of Scandinavian wood to the synagogue, and he is about to give an air conditioner in their memory to the changing room at the soccer field, so that the players can get some air at halftime." Is God in the details? Certainly God, or God's heedless wit and painterly pen, is in Amos Oz's details. Like many of his novels, Don't Call It Night, published in Israel in 1994, and now translated by Nicholas DeLange, concerns itself with the tiny and extraordinary business of daily life in Israel. Such a narrative is invaluable, and in Oz's hands it is also vivid, convincing, and haunting. Yet one imagines that in a country as new and complicated as Israel, a more politically uncertain writer would not write such a tame and domestic book. Consider the angry, brilliant novels of the South African writer J.M. Coetzee, whose recent narratives are so searching and searing, simultaneously anti-revolutionary and anti-government. Despite the presence among its characters of a possible arms dealer, despite a reference to a wide valley full of secret installations, and despite the casual discussion of various Israeli military victories and defeats, Don't Call It Night is really a novel about neglected bougainvillea. It is about being old enough to glimpse at last one's own death, to see the set stage of one's own final years, and to accept it with only the shortest, politest bursts of argument. This novel is a piece of sweet but melancholy chamber music, light but not necessarily insubstantial. It belongs to a genre of restful novel that is ruled by an aesthetic of peace and a yearning for peace. If one is looking for politics, there is that, clearly, if quietly. 1996. Christmas for Everyone. Oy, the holidays with our 2-year-old boy. Despite our anti-ceremonialist leanings, it is time to do something commemorative at home. There is, after all, a possibility that at 2, he will remember this as his first holiday season. Performance anxiety pervades the household. We have to do all the holidays if we do any. Hanukkah for my husband, Kwanzaa for my son, and of course, Christmas, I think in my Gentile-centric way, for everyone. Our family is an improvisation. Do we have to do Kwanzaa? It's really just an invention, my husband says. It's artificial. Unlike Santa Claus, who is so natural? I own a book on Kwanzaa. I've opened it, spotted a lot of illustrations of craft items to make at home, then shut it in a sweat. I need more help with this. My husband's holiday indifference now seems like laziness. He hasn't a clue when Hanukkah begins this year. I find myself saying loudly, why does the shiksa have to get out the menorah every year? Why does the shiksa always have to light the candles? All our 2-year-old wants out of the holidays is gum. He spotted some once in the mouth of a babysitter, and since then he has staged his own toddler version of a radio pledge drive. Gum, gum, gum. He studies my mouth for telltale movements. If I bite my tongue or if I have my marital tongue in my cheek, he says hopefully, Mommy, what's in your mouth? You have gum? This year, it's 1996, we get a slightly dehydrated Christmas tree, park it close to the radiator, and decorate it in a crazed slapdash way. Next morning, all the needles drop. The tree now resembles a giant TV antenna. On Christmas Eve, we build a fire, then snuff it out with an old wet towel, realizing fearfully that we haven't cleaned the flue in 5 years. Then the boiler breaks down. We plug in the space heaters. We order takeout Chinese. Only then, when almost all is lost and I am feeling so unexpectedly sad, do I realize what a sucker I am for the beautiful fake Christmas that German-American commerce concocted for us years ago. I actually like the shopping, the gift wrap, the carols. I like the invented holiday miracles, the unexpected kindnesses and transformations, at least as they are portrayed on the TV specials. And looking out the window and seeing only sleet, I realize that I even like the snow. Where now is that lovely, perfect Christmas? On whose open fire are those goddamn chestnuts roasting? I have a fiction writer's weakness for fiction. It's an occupational hazard. Well, I say, serving sliced water chestnuts instead, can I serve up some cheer as well? Merry Christmas, you guys! Merry, merry Christmas! Our 2-year-old is watching my lips and jaw. His eyebrows lift and his eyes grow knowing and bright. Mommy? He says, you have gum? 1997. Star, Clinton Lewinsky. Oh, the autoimmune disorder that is the Star Clinton Lewinsky matter. Inadequate foes, or somehow unimpressive ones, have our government geared up and attacking itself. We are paralyzed and thrilled in that sickened sort of way. Terrorists can't bomb the scandal away, planes and stock markets can't crash it away, JonBenet Ramsey and Neil LaBute can't frighten it away. As was said in Chicago in 1968, the whole world is watching, while we collapse into our wheelchair parked in front of CNN and have our nervous breakdown. Full disclosure, I find Linda Tripp's moral position intriguing and literary. I believe Paula Jones was degraded by her boss, probably illegally so. And I did not vote for Bill Clinton. though now I feel sorry for him in the same way I felt sorry for Pee-wee Herman when he was arrested in that Florida movie theater. I voted in various primaries and elections for Jesse Jackson, Jerry Brown, and Ralph Nader. Clinton, in office, has been dismaying in predictable ways. His centrist judiciary appointments, his botched national health plan, his gaze in the military debacle, his generally compromised or meretricious or dithering policymaking. I have mostly thought that he was a charming shark, a user, a yuppie, a bad actor, and a sexy lying fool. This he has in common with many people, perhaps even poor Pee-wee Herman. Still, at no point in his life did Bill Clinton ever say, "I am not a sex addict." Those who voted for him knew something of his unfortunate and compulsive personal life and decided they didn't care. Now suddenly voters care? I don't think so. Now suddenly Congress is shocked? Where are the true and the brave? Now suddenly congressional Democrats and the First Lady herself are feigning sad or angry surprise in order to affect a kind of independence from this guy and keep their pathetically unproductive jobs. Is the paycheck really that good? Surely there are many reasons that the Lewinsky affair has taken over our national conversation. One, the political emptiness of the Clinton White House. Both nature and political theater abhor a vacuum. Caught in a kind of Beckettian holding pattern, the Clinton presidency got overtaken by a sex comedy more popular with the summer stock crowd. Two, the fudged look of the Clinton marriage. We gaze upon the first family the way children would, imagining we are part of it, always feeling on behalf of Chelsea, and wondering what the heck Mom and Dad are up to. Yet Bill and Hillary's weird unhappiness repels us. Weird unhappiness is never as attractive as weird fun. And what is even more interesting is weird fun paid for with union support, cabinet trust, grand jury testimony, public humiliation, and impeachment talk. Three. Finally, there is the strange, not-to-be-thwarted character of Ken Starr, future Time Man of the Year. And where is the stuff about the land deal, Mr. Starr? That our ungentlemanly president's gentlemanly failure to kiss and tell should be subjected to the legalisms of judiciary procedure is, of course, total madness, a torture and a regicide which could only have been brought about by Starr, the crazed zealot the right wing didn't even know it had. He is, of course, Victor Hugo's Javert, but he has not pursued Jean Valjean. In fact, in a bit of publicly funded intertextual surrealism and downsized literary ambition, he has leaped completely out of the book and pursued Terry Southern's Candy. For this, we pay taxes. Dear God, bring back the NEA. 1998. Ann Beattie's New and Selected Stories. There is always something a little nervous-making about a book of new and selected work. There is a whiff of the memorial about it, a funereal taking of stock, maybe an anxious seeking of a new audience which can signal a slowing of forward movement in the oeuvre. There is always some new work, but it is never the point. The new work has somehow wandered in, arrived unbidden. It is unselected, like neighbors crashing a family reunion. Yet there is a kind of magnificence to Ann Beattie's Park City New and Selected Stories. The collection comprises 36 stories written over a 25-year period, and in reading them, one after another, one feels amazed at the confidence, steadiness, and quality of the output. Certainly such a book will highlight its author's habits and predilections, and that is part of the fun and education of it for any reader. But Park City is also a book that should win the admiration of short story writers and readers everywhere for its pointed reminder of Beattie's unshakably intelligent, deep-hearted, long, and unsurpassed devotion to the genre. Ann Beattie's first collection, Distortions, was published in 1976, and she quickly came to seem an avatar of that particular time, Its historical aftermath and drift, its growing affluence and friendly generational narcissism. Now, of course, she is writing at a time that seems to have no avatars, and, the end of the millennium notwithstanding, may not even be a particular time. So it is interesting to see the ways in which her work has both changed and not changed through the decades. Distortions is represented here by four stories, all tales of marriage and divorce. In Vermont, a couple played host to the wife's ex-husband, who brings with him not only some low-grade confusion, but a very young new girlfriend. Everyone is nice, everyone behaves, and the new girlfriend, appropriately enough, wonders aloud whether, every time we sleep, we die, we come back another person, to another life. In Dwarf House, Tammy Wynette sings D-I-V-O-R-C-E on a jukebox while a married man has a beer with his secretary. Are you happy? The story begins with him saying. Because if you're happy, I'll leave you alone. In Wolf Dreams, a young woman on the eve of her third marriage becomes so agitated, she writes an angry letter to the president. She begins to think that it's Nixon's fault. All of it, whatever that means. In Snake's Shoes, as in Vermont, a remarried woman, here named Alice, is visited by her ex, with whom she has a daughter. The reason for the divorce, as stated by Alice at the time, reflects Beattie's own penchant for the uninflected event. He acts like a madman with that boat. He swamped her three times this year. I've been seeing someone else. At the end of the story, the former family takes an evening walk, just the three of them, and Alice, insisting on her turn in the game, says, "Don't forget me," and her ex-husband kisses her on the neck. Here in Distortions, we see the themes of almost all of Beattie's stories to come. Sexual infidelity as plot point, divorce as cultural landscape, the comic desire for the personal somehow to be political, and the civilized management of the past by means of a creative mix of remembering and forgetting. From these very first stories straight through to the new ones in the book's Park City section, Beattie's recoupled couples are afflicted with a nagging fear of erasure. She thought for a moment about people who had disappeared. Judge Crater, Amelia Earhart, Mrs. Ramsey. Or, he had wanted her to know that he had been there, a real person, someone she needed to factor into the landscape. Because their world is white, educated, upper middle class, and pharmaceutically calm, no one ever struggles convincingly at a job, inheritances are referred to in many of the stories, the thing that jeopardizes their safety most, the precipitating event for any possible story, is the prospect and actuality of uncoupling. Alice's, "Don't forget me," which in Snake Shoes is uttered as a simple, "Now it's my turn" request, is made, by Beattie's subtle art, into a pained and plaintive cry. It is a cry that, along with the lyrics of Bob Dylan, echoes across the decades of Beattie's work. Everywhere her characters, parents and children, have been confronted with their own insignificance, not through any cosmic perspective, but simply through the rude spiritual lens of broken marriage. For the reader, it must be added, these are highly literary breakups. Beattie isn't interested in any real anatomy of divorce, the usual stresses on relationships, issues of money, work, energy, and time, are not examined here. Divorce is affected swiftly, largely through mysterious, almost poetic acts of ego and infidelity. In Beattie's fictional world, divorce is emotional crisis made narrative tool, the monster in the tale. The trick for her characters is somehow to defang it, live with it in a comic fashion, which they do, if bittersweetly. They have good, merry friends. Beattie's work is a tireless valentine to friendship, which helps. It was in the 1970s when Beattie began writing and publishing that divorce first became epidemic, and in insistently fashioning narratives around that social fact, Beattie, more than any other American writer, registered the event, She did so by assuming it, its newfound ordinariness, its sad but essentially untragic nature, its ability to redefine in curious ways the shape and composition of families. One can hear